The Triathlon Show 377. What's up, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by scientifictriathlon.com. I'm your host, Michael, and on today's episode, we have the second Q&A episode of the year, and for this one, I am happy to announce that I will have a co-host. This will be done with scientific triathlon coach and professional long-distance triathlete Jack Hutchins. He has a background in swimming and surf lifesaving and swim coaching, so he brings a lot of knowledge and experience to the table for us to have really good and well-rounded answers to the questions we have received, and we have received a lot, so I'm very happy for that, and we should have a good Q&A episode in store. Just a quick note as well that the next Q&A episode that I will be doing will be probably in March, and it will be on bike training, and I am accepting questions for that one already, so feel free to email me anytime when you have questions, and like this one, I will try to do it with a co-host if possible, if I can get somebody to come on, because I find that it just makes for a little bit easier and better listening when you have two people chatting rather than just one, and you can have a bit more of a, you can have some, get some more different perspectives, I guess. Before we get into the Q&A, a big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Fuel and Hydration, that help athletes perform at their best with electrolyte and fueling products and with free online tools, education content, and a patented sweat test. You can use their free fuel and hydration planner to get a personalized plan for your carbohydrate, sodium, and fluid intake, and you can also book a free 20-minute video consultation to chat through your plan with the athlete support team. As a salty sweater myself, their highly concentrated electrolytes are very important to me in longer workouts and races, and there are no gels that I find as easy to consume even in large quantities as the Precision Fuel gels. You can get 15% off your first order by using the code TTS23 on precisionfuelandhydration.com. And thank you to Form. The Form Smart Swim Goggles give you real-time feedback in your swim training through a display on the goggle lens. You can see every split to the hundredth of a second. You can see live stroke rate information and even live heart rate through integration with Polar heart rate monitors. All of this helps you execute your swim workouts more optimally with better control of intensity and better pacing. You also can get access to in-depth post-swim analysis with additional metrics in the app, which syncs your workout seamlessly to platforms like Training Peaks, Strava, Today's Plan, and Final Surge. The app also has a vast library of workouts and training plans, or you can build your own guided workouts. Get 15% off the goggles with the code TTS15 on formswim.com/TTS. Now, without any further ado, let's get into the Q&A together with Coach Jack Hutchins. So here with me to answer today's questions on swim training is Coach Jack Hutchins. Jack, welcome. How are you doing?
I'm good, thanks. How are you, Michael?
I'm good as well. Just before we start answering the questions, can you give the listeners a brief introduction to yourself?
Yeah, sure. So I'm a scientific triathlon coach. My background in coaching, I started off swim coaching. I was head coach of a swimming club for a few years. I also competed in surf lifesaving and grew up on the coast, so I have kind of a bit of experience swimming in those kind of environments. As an athlete, I race in the professional ranks of long course triathlon. And yeah, I'm excited to have a go at answering some listener questions.
Yeah, great. And we'll try to tackle these kind of relatively succinctly because we have a lot of questions to get to. But yeah, let's just crack on. I'll read the question and you can give your answer first, and then I'll chime in with if I have anything to add. The first question is from Toine from the Netherlands, who writes, I swim just once a week in the pool in the late spring and summer. In the late spring and summer, twice per week in the open water, always in a wetsuit or shorty. I normally do 2 70-on-3 events in a year. I struggle a lot with sinking legs in the pool, and it takes a lot of energy. Now I wear buoyancy swimming shorts, and it takes a lot less energy, and I can focus more on my technique, and it gives me more fun in the pool. What do you think about this? Do I get lazy with the buoyancy shorts, or doesn't it really matter because I swim the 70-on-3 races in a wetsuit only?
Yeah, so I think anything that's going to get you swimming more is only going to be a good thing. If you're racing in a wetsuit, then you could even argue that swimming in the buoyancy shorts is more specific to that. Clearly, as you know, it is going to affect your body position. So perhaps You could do the occasional kind of technique session focused on your body position without the shorts. And then when you come back to using the shorts or a wetsuit, it potentially is going to be even better. Or just kind of being aware that it is having that impact on the strokes and making sure you are focusing on your body position a little bit more when you're kind of swimming with the shorts. But anything that's going to get you swimming more, and as you said, if it allows you to focus on other aspects of your stroke, then I think it can't, it's kind of sounds like it's doing more good than harm.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that as well. Don't have too much to add, but especially if he or she is swimming once per week during the winter season in the pool, then yeah, that one swim per week, just try to get some good strokes in, and the shorts clearly help with getting good, better strokes in, because you don't have to worry about the sinking legs too much. I think a lot of athletes, to be honest, could benefit from this. And of course, if you are going to do something like Kona or something like that, then you would need to train a lot without them to practice that. But if you're racing in a wetsuit always, then yeah, I think that you can get pretty far for an amateur athlete by just training relative specifically to that with the added buoyancy that the shorts provide.
Yeah, definitely. I need to get myself some of those shorts. I want to have a go.
Yeah. Next question. Hello, Michael. I have a question about swimming. How should one train for an open water swim when open water is unavailable? What is the best course of action in the pool?
So yeah, I mean, firstly, the pool is a kind of more controlled environment, so it is usually better for this to make up the bulk of your training. I would say that adding in kind of basic open water skills, if you can, in the pool, so sighting, drafting, potentially turning around a buoy in the pool, can all be done, and that obviously is going to help when you go to the open water. One problem with being in the pool is every length you've got a turn and a push off the wall, so you're kind of giving your arms a break, which isn't obviously the case in open water. So one thing that I do when I coach kind of groups of swimmers who are training for open water is I get them to swim lengths without pushing off the wall, so they would potentially turn just off the wall, and so that kind of gives them that continuous stimulus of swimming without the break, and also it's a good opportunity to practice your kind of tight turns in the pool environment.
Yeah, no, I like that. That's a great exercise, and I think that the challenge is logistically, if you don't swim with a group, what do you do then? But maybe you can get a couple of friends, and then if the two of you or three of you or four of you can kind of you can get a lane for yourself, then you can choose to do this swim and agree to do this swim together and do that kind of practice. And then additionally, you can also do things like maybe sprinting side by side to simulate a race start, and also do some swimming in a pace line to simulate swimming on somebody's feet or somebody's hips. And that's actually, if you're three people, for example, or even four people, you can do like a diamond shape and just swim up and down, and you can take turns to be on the sides or in the front or at the back. And then I would also say that it really depends how much you need to do. It depends on how you perform relative to your pool swimming strength when you're in the open water. Do you perform on par to your pool swimming strength, or do you perform actually better in the open water or worse in the open water? Obviously, if you perform worse in the open water relative to your pool swimming strength, then you would want to focus a bit more on the open water specific elements. But if you tend to perform better in the open water than in the pool, then maybe it's not something that you need to put a huge amount of effort into. Would you agree with that, Jack?
Yeah, definitely. I think there's, you know, making sure that you could potentially add in some open water sessions as you approach your race as well is going to kind of help with that specificity towards that kind of last block. But you know, recognizing that there are differences between swimming in the pool and open water is kind of key there.
Yeah, and one thing as well, like it sounds like this listener has actually no open water available, which is obviously something that is possible depending on where you live. But when you go to a race, just make sure that you maybe have a couple of days at the location where you can swim at the race venue, and that I would say is true regardless of if you are able to swim in the open water normally or not. If you can get two swims at the race venue in the open water before race day, then that can be quite helpful and just get you used to swimming in the open water in those specific conditions where you will be racing. So that's something to consider as well when you plan your logistics around travel.
Yeah, definitely. And if you can't kind of swim around the exact course, even just making sure that you're revising the course so you're kind of aware of what you're going to face on race day, because some of these courses can have quite kind of tight turns and different like intricacies that can be quite confusing if you've not kind of had a look at a race plan or practiced it on the actual course.
Yeah. All right. I think that's that for that question. The next one is from Ashley, who writes, I am extremely time crunched for swimming due to travel, the travel time to the pool. I recently picked up a Sen 8 swim trainer and wonder what's the most effective way to transfer training from the Sen 8 to the pool, and what's the bare minimum of training in the pool, and what's the most that I should use the Sen 8? What's the best way to adjust this over a season? Do you have any experience with the Sen 8, Jack?
Not with the Sen 8 specifically. I'm aware of it. I've used kind of swim specific stretch cords quite a bit, which I found really beneficial. I guess with regards to this question, the kind of minimum amount, it does depend on your kind of background and goals. It's hard to give like a specific number there, but it is, you know, really good for kind of specific conditioning and kind of allows you to ingrain that specific swimming movement pattern, I've found. But it doesn't allow you to get a proper feel for the water, so that's where you need to kind of recognize its limitations, I guess. But the Sen 8 puts you in a kind of prone position, right? So it is more specific than just using the cords.
Yeah. So I think, the question is, what is the bare minimum of training in the pool and the most that the Sen 8 should be used as a supplement, I guess. Well, I think that the first question, the bare minimum of the pool, I think that if you can get two pool sessions in weekly, that would be great. I mean, it depends on what your level is. For some people, that will not be enough to improve, but for quite a few people, it could be enough to improve if you also supplement with some dry land training like the Sen 8. Or at least it could help you maintain and make sure that you don't lose anything that you have built up over the years of training. So I would say that two weekly pool sessions would be good to try to aim for as a bare minimum. Of course, more is going to be better, as you know, but if you get two of them done, that's a really good start, I would say. And then in terms of what is the maximum that you should use the Sen 8, I don't know that there's a maximum. It comes down to how much time you have overall for training, because obviously it's also an opportunity cost of running and cycling. So if you have lots of time for training but you just can't get to the pool, then you can use it a lot. And if you don't have so much overall time, then use it one or two short sessions maybe in the week to supplement your two pool sessions, and then focus the rest on the bike and the run is what I would say.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, if you could even kind of block out some time where you could focus a little bit more potentially over the year, you're very time crunch, but is there, you know, strategic points on an approach to a race that you could add another session in or two and kind of have that as the kind of compromise for less swimming kind of in other parts of the build up? Might be a nice way to do it if that's possible.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And I think that really helps, because it also works in reverse. I feel that you can be quite consistent for some time, but if you're not a really good swimmer, when you then have you travel for 2 weeks and you can't swim, you can lose that quite quickly. But if you can block off those 3 weeks leading into a race or 6 weeks leading into a race and make sure that you can swim very consistently, maybe a bit more than normal, in those weeks, and then that can also help you build up quite well into that race. So I think that's a great point. Yeah, all right. So let's move on to the next question. And this one, well, there are two questions here. Let me just check who the question is from. It's from Everett. And Everett writes, I am a slow adult onset swimmer. I made great progress the past year with more time in the pool and following a program. I find it difficult to swim easy in zones one or two. What are some physical cues I should look for to make sure I'm not going too fast? The problem is that I find it hard to swim slow with good technique. Let's start with that one. What are your thoughts on that, Jack?
Well done for making great progress so far. That's kind of, you know, good effort, because most people do struggle with this in the pool. But I'd say going too fast is kind of a common problem. And there's a few kind of things that I would probably suggest. Technique wise, potentially, is making sure that you're stretching out to full extension and kind of using a nice rotation to make sure that you're maximizing that distance per stroke, rather than just kind of spinning the arms. You can also implement some kind of hypoxic training. So breathing every, if you breathe in every three, maybe breathe in every four, every five, that kind of forces you to slow down a little bit. Also, I'd probably look from like a programming point of view at potentially adding in some longer reps with less rest, because just the nature of that means that you're going to be more kind of, you have to swim them more aerobically rather than if you're doing lots of kind of shorter stuff and trying to slow down. Do you have anything else on that?
No, I think those are all the things that I had as well. I think when one thing in the, I guess, post-swim analysis, if you are doing those kinds of longer repetitions, look at how your speed, this is where using a watch sometimes can be a good thing. Like you can get lap by lap paces and you can see, well, did I start out way too fast and then slow down, or was I pretty steady? Because the idea would be that you would want to be quite steady. So then you can use that as feedback for next session as well. On the hypoxic one, I think I kind of agree with that, but I also personally, I wouldn't want to do it as hypoxic. I wouldn't want to get to the point of like feeling that hypoxic, you know, sensation. But I would say that personally, at least my preference would be, if I do a hard set with breathing every two strokes, I would go to breathing every three strokes, which is still comfortable, doesn't feel hypoxic, but it is not something that I would do in my harder sets. So going up in breathing or down in breathing frequency, but without it being like too much of a stretch, is maybe the way I would go on that one. But I do find that is a really good cue.
Yeah, for sure. That's a good point. If you're doing kind of quality swimming then, or more intensity, then I'd definitely say you want all the oxygen you can get there. But I guess that also, breathing less frequently comes into increasing that distance per stroke a little bit, because it does give you a little bit more time to focus on stretching out and rotating a little bit more.
Yeah, I think my point is just that I wouldn't advise necessarily being too hypoxic, like going too extreme on, because then you kind of lose focus on your technique and things like that. All you can think about is how bad you want some air. So just getting to that point where you're still fairly comfortable, but reducing the breathing frequency, I guess.
Yeah.
The second part of his question is, I feel my strokes per minute, my stroke rate is low. It's around 60 strokes per minute. Would it be worth it to try the tempo trainer to improve my stroke rate?
Oh, stroke rate, that's a bit of a, yeah. I mean, stroke rate is, in triathlon, it's kind of, there's been a bit of a culture of just, yeah, everyone needs to increase their stroke rate, but it is kind of an individual thing based on not only you as a person, but also, you know, what speed you're swimming at, what conditions you're swimming in, your kind of pull to kick frequency or ratio. And, you know, as the stroke rate increases, your stroke length drops potentially. So it's about finding that kind of sweet spot, I'd say. You know, you want to there's a few kind of things you could do in the pool, doing kind of series of reps at race pace and changing the rate and see how kind of easy it feels at different paces. But yeah, kind of I'll be cautious with stroke rate. Also, yeah, when you increase the stroke rate, you want to make sure that you increase the right part of the stroke. So you want to still make sure you're taking enough time to get a good hand entry and a good catch. And you want the increase in the rate to come from the acceleration of the pull back past towards the hips, and rather than it just being an increase in kind of complete windmilling. Yeah, if that makes sense. So yeah, I'll try those things with the stroke rate test set and play around with that, and also having different stroke rates for different kind of conditions or different situations. So in open water, typically it would be higher. If you're swimming faster, it would be higher. If you're in a pool, it's going to be lower. If it's a nice glassy day, then stroke rate is going to be lower, I'd say.
Yeah, I think I like that with the stroke rate test set. And I think that Swim Smooth have done this on a Swim Smooth course, a specific set of 50s, I think 10 50s, where you increase your stroke rate by maybe 2 every 50, and you record things like, well, your split, obviously, and your stroke rate, but also your RPE, your heart rate, if you measure heart rate. So those sorts of things. And that can be quite a good one as well to get a chart, basically, of your how effective you are at different stroke rates. And you can usually, you tend to see one or two break points where your stroke gets more or less effective, depending on which way you go. So that can be quite helpful as well as to do a specific test like that. And there the tempo trainer can be good. But I would agree that just increasing it for the sake of increasing it without knowing anything more is something that I would be a bit cautious with, because your 60 doesn't really say much. It could be really, really low, or it could be too high, depending on what your distance per stroke is, and so on. So it's just so individual. But what I would say is that when you get fitter, your stroke rate usually goes up automatically as well. So your distance per stroke might not go up, but your stroke rate, what feels like the same stroke rate is actually higher when you get fitter. That's generally what happens. So when you train to improve fitness, then you will generally, as a part of that, will be your stroke rate going up. So even if you're not focusing specifically on stroke rate.
Yeah, that's a good point. And even the ability to just hold the same stroke rate, most people's, I mentioned it before, maybe drops off quite quickly in especially in longer reps.
Yeah. And that's where a tool like the tempo trainer can be really useful, whether it's for like holding a constant stroke rate or for just hitting the beep, staying on pace when you're doing your longer reps. And now I'm using the form goggles. I really enjoyed that because you get that even more clearly, basically, the feedback if you're on pace or not. But the tempo trainer does the job just as well. And it really is a case of how long can you hold your pace, how long can you hold your stroke rate. And that's where a lot of athletes, I think, need a lot of work, a lot of improvement, that they can easily hold something for a certain distance, but not for a significantly longer distance. So, that's a good added point. Let's move on to the next question from Ryan, which is, I've done many running and biking races, but I am new to swimming events. I have a relatively weak and skinny upper body, and I'm wondering if this is holding back my swim potential. I did start swim training sessions with a tri group, which is helping with technique, but is there some strength or flexibility work I should or could be doing outside of the pool?
Yes, definitely. I think some strength and mobility stuff or strength and flexibility work definitely will help. There's loads of good information out there on kind of YouTube and online, but I'd say kind of focusing on the shoulders, neck, back, ankles for mobility stuff. For kind of strength wise, obviously we already talked about the Zen 8, and that's like really specific. So it's really good for, as I said, ingraining those specific movement patterns to the swim, but just general kind of strength work, looking at the core and kind of big muscle groups is going to help. And then specifically to swimming, kind of pull-ups, bent over rows, lat pull downs, triceps, and kind of deadlifts and those kind of things that are, yeah, really can benefit benefit you in the pool or in the swim.
Yeah. I think I have quite a bit of notes here because it's a question that I find very interesting and quite hard to answer, to be honest. I think that most athletes can definitely benefit from flexibility, mobility training, as you said, shoulders, neck, thoracic spine, ankles, and those are all really important. And it doesn't necessarily have to be a long, intricate routine. I think you can kind of combine it really well with a poolside warm-up. And even if it's a couple of minutes, 5 minutes at the most, then you can get some good things in, and that would be a good minimum viable flexibility routine. So that would be a good place to start. And most athletes, I think, would start to feel some positive benefits from doing that. In terms of strength, I think I agree with you. Like I'm a proponent of strength training, and I think like a lot of the exercises that you mentioned, there are exercises that I prescribe, like bent over rows, lat pull down, tricep extensions. Those would be kind of the swim specific ones that I would gravitate towards. But I would also, I don't know, I have this feeling that very few adult onset males in particular are limited by their actual strength in the pool. When we're talking triathletes or open water swimmers that do long events, it's maybe different if you're doing the 50 or 100 free or something like that. And obviously it's very different if you are a very good swimmer, like a high level swimmer, and you're doing those sprint distance events or middle distance swimming events, then it's a no brainer. You need to be doing some quite specific strength training, and you need to be doing quite a lot of it probably to really maximize your potential. But I don't necessarily have the feeling that most adult onset males in particular are limited by their strength training. But that's not to say that I don't recommend strength training. I do, but I think that it's quite a general adaptation that you're getting from it. And I'm not sure how directly it's going to translate to direct speed in the water, but I think over time it will probably help you maintain your muscle function better, like over the years, let's say, and it will be a good balance to long endurance training, to do some, which is a very high intensity training when you do some kind of strength training. So I do think it's good, but I do have that caveat that I'm not sure how directly it translates to speed in the water.
Yeah, that's a good point. I guess if it's going, you know, being in the water should always come first as a priority. I guess the other aspect would be the kind of hormonal response as well that you get from the strength training, which is more of a general kind of benefit. I do see where you're coming from. I agree with you there.
And I think that the benefits are quite a lot clearer when it comes to the running and the cycling. Mm. So if you are going to go to the gym and work out in the gym, then it's very easy to add one or at most two swim-specific or upper body exercises as well while you're already in the gym. And it's not going to have any negative impact and possibly some positive impact. But I think that in terms of the scientific evidence, there's quite a lot for running and cycling, but there's not that clear evidence for swimming. So and that's kind of anecdotally as well my experience that it's a bit unclear. But that being said, if you are doing strength training anyway, then definitely it makes sense to do something specific for swimming as part of that routine. So let's move on to the next question. This one is from, let me see here, Andreas. And Andreas writes, triathlon swim training is often based on normal swim training. They should know best how to get better at swimming, right? What should be done differently in triathlon swim training compared to normal swim training? Longer intervals, ? More or less technique, ? What should the ratio of technique focus to main work sets be? also at different times in the season and for different levels of swimmers. Should triathletes devote some time to learning the different strokes other than freestyle to become more flexible in their movement patterns? Your thoughts on limiters and how to overcome them, or transferring technique and speed from the pool to open water swimming? So there's a lot of questions there, so you can just grab a few and run with them.
Yeah, right. I mean, yes, swimming is swimming, but so just to answer the first question, swim coaches should know how to get better at swimming because it is just swimming. But as we mentioned before, there's definitely some different considerations when it comes to triathlon swimming, kind of, you know, technique wise and training wise, which kind of you said there about the longer reps, which, you know, most kind of swim programs are focused, even if they're not racing, they're kind of off the back of focusing on shorter distance races. In terms of doing more or less technique stuff, again, that would probably depend on the individual, but I'd say it's probably wouldn't vary that much, but it would just be that the technique stuff might be slightly different based on the requirements of the triathlon swim. So rather than it being a lot of focus on kind of kick technique and you know, maximizing distance per stroke and obviously medley stuff, it might be more focused on the open water skills, as well as kind of being able to maintain good body position within the kind of open water environment. In terms of, you said about the different strokes, I'm a big advocate of triathletes kind of doing different strokes. I think if you can't already do the strokes, then it's probably not worth learning them. But if you are familiar with all the strokes and you can do them, then I think it is worth including them a little bit in your training. It kind of is good for evening out muscular imbalances, you know, technical improvements and feel for the water. So, you know, moving yourself differently through the water kind of helps and comes back to your freestyle. Power generation, especially in butterfly, you have to generate a lot of power just to get your arms above the water. So I think that helps when it comes back to freestyle. Just general kind of variety and enjoyment, which, you know, you might potentially get from doing a bit of medley stuff in your kind of triathlon swim program. But as I said, I don't think it's worth focusing too much on developing the other strokes, but just including them in there is not really going to hurt at all. In terms of, you said,
Jack, on that, I'm curious. Yeah. Do you have like a level that an athlete would be at for it to be worth it to include the other strokes? Let's say you can swim a 100 free in 115, so you're good by triathlon age group standards, but obviously not a swimmer and not a professional triathlete. But what would the level be that you would say that, okay, if you can swim a 130 back, then it's worth including, or do you have anything like any benchmarks like that?
It's hard to put a specific number on it, I guess, again, just because some people do. I mean, I've coached people who are just such, you know, naturals at a particular stroke, and so, you know, they might not be actually the strongest freestylers when it comes to triathlon swimming, but they can just swim butterfly really well, or they got a really nice backstroke. And so for them, you know, including it and continuing doing it within their triathlon program is potentially a benefit, or at least not a hindrance. In terms of, yeah, specific numbers or times, I probably would struggle to put a specific time. Yeah.
Fair enough.
And then I think Andrea said about the transferring pool to open water. And again, we've touched on, goes back to those open water skills. I think a big thing is confidence in the open water. So being comfortable in that environment. And so that kind of comes from exposure to being in that kind of position, and kind of pacing and not rushing it. So in open water or triathlon, people often go out too hard, I think. And, you know, they end up having a big loss in efficiency because they're trying to fight the water rather than just kind of relaxing. And the speed probably won't reduce by much, or if not at all, but you're definitely going to be fresher going onto the bike, and probably in the grand scheme of the triathlon will be in a better position.
What about, there was that one question or one part of the question, what should the ratio of technique focus to main work sets be? That's again a question that's hard to put a number on, but
yeah, any technique ratio to
thoughts on that?
Thoughts, I guess it depends on the where they are in the training cycle. So probably earlier on, when you're further away from your races, you'd probably put more of a emphasis on technique. You know, it could even be that, you know, up to or even all of the swim programming could be just focused on improving efficiency and technique 100% of your swimming to start with. And then as you start to add in more specific training, then you can just put that technique work into more of a top up slash maintenance mode, and increase the specific workouts, reduce the technique stuff. So putting the ratio down to, you know, more like, you know, 10%, I guess, of total volume.
I mean, I think on that technique part, actually, or just a general thing first. So I think one of the main differences with triathlon swimming versus normal swimmers is that as triathletes, we have a lot less time to swim. So we have more constraints. And I think that with that, it's really important to be focused, knowing what exactly it is you want to improve and what you need to improve, because you just don't have the luxury of being able to swim 60k per week. You might have to get away, if you're a normal typical age grouper, you might have to do 8 or 9k per week or 10k per week, or if you're like a very ambitious age grouper, you might be doing 15k plus or 20k, just about 20k. Most pros don't do like that much, nothing crazy, like 20k, a bit more than 20k would be quite normal. So it's not a lot compared to swimmers. So I think that's just something that should inform everything you do as a triathlete, is that make it count and know what you need to do, whether it's technique or like fitness or whatever it might be, open water skills. On the technique question, the ratio of technique to main work sets. So, I mean, I think that in a way, all swimming is technique, whether you're swimming hard or swimming easy, or you're doing drills, or you're always practicing technique. You never stop working on it. No matter what the workout is, there's always a technical focus. So I think that, that's my kind of my mindset to it, that you're always working on technique. But if the question is more about, let's say, drill sets to main work sets, then it's a very different question, because my personal opinion is that if you're an amateur triathlete going to the pool on your own with no coach on deck to give you feedback, then I don't think that there's a huge amount to gain from doing drills just because you saw them on a YouTube channel, unless you have them from, let's say, a video analysis or like a coached one-to-one session that you did, or something like an endless pool session or so on, where the coach told you that, okay, these are the 2 to 3 drills that you could be working on to improve this aspect of your stroke, and do that for a month and then come back and we reassess. In that case, obviously, you have a very specific reason to be doing drill sets, and it can help you improve a lot. But one thing that I'm kind of against is to do drills just for the sake of doing drills. So that's something that I would advise against. And then I would rather just the athlete doing as their technique sets. Let's say you can do a 10 by 100 and you can mix up the different toys that you're using, like use a snorkel for one set and fins for another, and just focus a bit on the constraints-based learning that the different tools allow you to practice. And I'm a big fan of the snorkel as well for the, I would say, for technique work, to just be able to visualize a bit where you're placing your hand and your alignment and so on. So in a lot of cases, just swimming with different tools can help you with the technique work. Other strokes, I'm more or less on the same page. I really don't think it makes sense to learn the other strokes if you don't know them. But if you do know them, then you can definitely include them in your sets. I think from the reason that I ask is that I kind of have the feeling that you should know them reasonably well to for it to be worth it to include them. Not, you don't have to be great at them, but you should be okay at them. Otherwise, maybe it doesn't make so much sense. But I also can't put a number to it. And I guess one part of the question is what should be done differently? Well, we touched on that with the I think one thing we didn't touch on, what should be done differently between triathletes and swimmers, is that keep in mind that our shortest event is 750 meters swimming, and the longest is 3,800 meters in the standard triathlon distances. So that's very different than a 53 up to a 1,500 free in the pool. So we are talking about kind of a different focus on energy systems, in that we need to do a lot of endurance work and a lot of kind of higher aerobic intervals. So let's say threshold tempo work, that sort of stuff. And we need to do a little bit of VO2 work. But I think for triathletes, the distribution is different than for swimmers, because for swimmers, they might be doing a lot of sprints if they're a sprinter, or a lot of VO2 work if they're basically anywhere else, anything other than a sprinter, because that's where their events will be performed. Whereas for triathletes, especially if we're talking Olympic distance and above, a lot of the focus is kind of threshold swimming. That's the intensity domain where the swimming happens in our races. So I think that it makes no sense to spend a lot of time doing very anaerobic training and a bunch of VO2 work. You should definitely do a bit of VO2 work, but it doesn't have to be like too much. And a lot of the focus, I think, should be more focus on threshold and high aerobic stuff, and then the endurance stuff than a swimmer would do, just because the event duration is so different.
Yeah, I think just wanted to go back to what you said about the. I definitely agree that, you know, you should always be, and this just goes for any training, you're thinking about how you can be the most efficient. So you are. There's always an element of kind of technique work with every stroke that you take, and there should be. I think that's a really good and important point. I also wanted to just touch on what you said about the drills, and I think I do agree that there shouldn't be a drill without you recognizing that you are focusing on technique, but just doing something different within the stroke, the same way that putting a snorkel on or using other toys makes you think about something different. I think sometimes just saying to an athlete, or just doing a single arm drill, even if there's not a specific kind of focus, it does make them, or it makes the athlete have to travel through the water slightly differently, and it makes them have to think about what they're doing a little bit more. So, that's kind of point I had there.
Yeah, no, that's true. And I think also, as long as you do the drills, like do them relatively well, but I think this is another point when you do drills that I would say at least do them well and use tools to help you do them well. So use fins for a lot of drills. A lot of age groupers need to use fins to be able to do things like, let's say, side kick or fins and snorkel, a good combo as well for a lot of drills. So I would say that if you do them well and you know what you're supposed to be working on, then they can definitely be very, very useful. It's more so that just mindlessly following a workout plan without really knowing why it's there. That's what I would try to caution against. Just one more thing was on the pool to open, transferring the pool training to open water training. I think, well, we mentioned training in the open water if you can, but do open water races if you can. That's also really fun, and it's really great training. So that's one thing. Also do triathlon races, do a sprint triathlon, do an Olympic triathlon, Olympic distance triathlon. If you can get to the Olympics, then do that for sure. But yeah, those races, they help, and the swimming in particular is something that when you get more experience, you get better at it. So that's one more point that I had on that. And the next one is, what are the pros and cons of using critical swim speed testing to figure out training paces for swimming? I personally really like the test because I find it to be very easy to pace properly, and it's not very disruptive to my training. Does it tend to overestimate or underestimate CSS for some athletes based on the athlete's characteristics, or are the errors more random in nature? Could these swimming paces be better constrained by an additional time trial, such as an 800 or 1000 time trial done on a separate day? How would you incorporate the additional information into the CSS model?
Yeah, so I mean, the CSS is usually, you know, used kind of two swims, and it measures kind of the drop off between them. So it should predict the longer distance roughly. But as you've kind of alluded to there, doing a longer time trial on a separate day is can be really insightful. And if it does correlate with the CSS, then you kind of know that you're pretty well rounded within across the distances. But if it doesn't, then potentially there is more of a gap there on the at either end of the spectrum, and it gives you somewhere to kind of focus, I would say.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's one of the big advantages of doing a three-point critical speed or critical power test, that you can, when you do a two-point test, then you always get that kind of linear regression that will go through both of those data points. So you will think that you get a perfect fit, but then when you add a third test, then you will see that, well, the fit is not perfect. And then you can see that, where is it that you are kind of over or underperforming? Is it on the short end or on the long end of things? So yeah, I like to use three time trials, so 100, 400, and 1900 for CSS testing. And if you're slower than, let's say, 35 minutes for 1900, then you could do a 1500 instead. And it is important to know that the critical speed or critical power is always going to be influenced by the selection of time trials. It's no different in cycling or running as well. If you do a 3 minute and a 20 minute critical power test, it's going to be different than a 3 minute and a 12 and 20. So it's not that any one selection of tests is wrong, but I think that it's more useful and helpful from a training standpoint when you have a larger range of tests. So I've found that adding the 1900 time trial pace that really gives that's where critical speed ends up being in swimmers that have good endurance. And if you don't, if your critical speed doesn't end up being there, then that can be a good kind of goal to have, that, okay, let me get my critical speed up to my 1900, or my 1900 pace up to my critical speed, I should say. So in the 1900 test, I think, is also, if you don't want to do three different tests, I would just do that one, and then that you can use that as a rough proxy for kind of your threshold. So, and it even aligns well with lactate from the albeit limited amount of testing that I've done there in swimming. Well, the question about what are the pros and cons of critical speed, well, I think the critical power, critical speed concept has a lot of scientific validity behind it. It's valid as a threshold from that standpoint. It aligns well with like the threshold 2, LT2 in swimming from what I've seen, when you do it with the test selection of 100, 400, 1900 at least. The drawbacks, I guess, are that... the drawbacks again come down to test selection, I would say. So if you don't have good endurance in swimming, then a 400 or 200 test, which is the most used CSS test, I think, is going to give you a critical speed that is too fast. It's faster than your steady state, so you would potentially be doing a lot of your training too hard. But I also don't think you have to do a critical speed test necessarily. If you do, let's say you want to do a kind of a good threshold workout would be 8 times 300 meters, with building to, maybe you could start with longer recoveries, but you could over time get down to 30 second recoveries or so. And I think when you do that test at a steady speed that you can maintain, but you're tired at the end, then you know that, okay, this is probably right around my threshold. So you can also find your zones through workouts like that. So there's no one size fits all. Critical speed testing is not the be all end all, but it is useful, I think. And I think that it is particularly useful when you broaden the range of the time trials a little bit. And we have a follow-up question, a second question here. These questions are from William. And the second one is, do you have suggestions for simulating open water swimming in choppy conditions, such as in an ocean? Yeah, I think that's the question, basically. What are your thoughts, Jack?
Simulating open water choppy conditions. I mean, going down to the local pool when it's really busy is sometimes feels like you're swimming in open water. I mean, in terms of, as I said earlier, I think the turn is probably the biggest difference from open water to the pool, and having that push off. So if you can eliminate that in some way by doing kind of laps of a wider lane, or not pushing off the wall, then that's probably the biggest thing in terms of kind of mastering choppy conditions. Then, you know, making sure that you can sight well, and you can also incorporate that sight into your stroke cycle well. When it's choppy, you're going to need to sight even higher up, so it's going to interrupt the stroke even more. So if you can, you know, make sure that your sighting is as smooth and interrupts the stroke the least amount, then lifting the head even more should be even easier. You potentially might need to sight, you know, on more frequently as well, and on multiple kind of strokes. So that would be where I'd kind of focus my attention if we're trying to kind of optimize swimming in choppy conditions.
Yeah, on that, I think that the water polo drill, so swimming with your head up for a few strokes, that can be good, because sometimes you might have to do that in a race when it's really choppy and you have to use several stroke cycles to see where you're going. And so that's a good drill to have as a to practice and have as a backup plan in case you don't see where you're going with your normal sighting. And then the other thing, also making sure that you can breathe to both sides, so that you can choose that based on where the chop is coming from. And the third question from William is, how does one incorporate swim specific movements / exercises in my strength / mobility training? I think we already talked about most of this. I'm just trying to see if there, well, he mentions that if I recall correctly from an earlier episode, there's not a lot of definitive evidence suggesting strength training leads to improved performance in triathlon swimming. Nevertheless, many of the high-profile strength and conditioning coaches you've interviewed talk about things such as shoulder or thoracic spine mobility and seem to incorporate some strength training for swimming. Can you comment on this apparent disconnect or clarify if I'm remembering incorrectly?
Sorry, I also just saw that he said about ocean swell in the previous question. I just wanted to quickly add on that one, is making sure you sight when you're at the top of the swell, because if you're not, then you're not going to be able to see above the line of the swell. So that's kind of, and you can also kind of time your stroke as well with the swell with practice, so that you're kind of pulling over the swell rather than through it. I just wanted to add on that one.
Yeah, I think there is that like lack of evidence in swimming compared to running and cycling for strength training as a direct causal link of improving performance. But I think he's also right that many good strength and conditioning coaches would recommend strength training. And I do think it helps, especially the mobility stuff. For me, the jury is a bit more out on the actual strength stuff. Not if we're talking about actual swimmers training for sprint events or middle distance swimming events, but if we're talking about amateurs in particular training for triathlon, then yeah, that's where for me the jury's out on the strength training. But definitely, I think that just working your muscles through a range of motion can't be a bad thing. So So I think it can also be just some basically neural adaptations of that that you might get there. So yeah, the answer is that I don't really know, to be honest.
Yeah, I definitely think with regards to the mobility, when you think about running and cycling, everyone can. The movement's not very extreme. It's kind of quite natural to the body. I guess you could argue maybe time trial positions is very extreme, but just cycling and running is pretty, you know, it's quite a natural instinctive movement. But swimming, if you look at elite swimmers, the positions they can get their shoulders and arms into, most people just can't do it. And it takes just so many years of swimming, growing up swimming, that they can kind of put their bodies in those positions. So it definitely... the mobility side is really worth putting some time into.
Yeah, and I think that's an area where maybe using things like stretch cords and elastic bands can be a useful strength training, even though it's not heavy strength, but it maybe allows you a bit better to work on applying a little bit of force, but through the very specific movement patterns that you want to be doing it in swimming. And you can do it on land where you have a better proprioception of what you're doing, and you can visually see what you're doing. So I think that kind of strength training with stretch cords, elastic bands, and a trainer and so on, that can have a role to play as a combined mobility and slight light strength workout, basically. Right, and then we have a question. This is the one, the long one with lots of images. So I'm just going to skip to the actual question. Basically, it's about CSS training, and the listener asks, I have been using CSS-based training over the years, and I was first introduced to it back in 2014 at the Swim Smooth Coaches Training Camp. One thing that I never understood was why we were using something that for most swimmers is in the 20 to 30 minute range to set as a threshold training pace, whereas critical power in running or cycling is the theoretical hour power or hour pace. So jumping a little bit further, the question is, Tom is the one asking. Tom asks, my question is, putting CSS as faster than LT2 seems to be appropriate. That's based on a link that he posted. Do you agree, and do you have any comments on this zoning and its applicability? Basically, the link is to a Triton Wear article. Triton produces some wearables in swimming. I think just a couple of comments on this, because we talked about most of it in the other CSS question. I found that depending on test selection, LT2 and CSS can be completely aligned. That's my experience with the 100, 400, 1900. And I think that they're both trying to get to the same point, or that it's different ways, of course. Like critical speed, critical power is a different concept than a lactate threshold, because lactate is only measuring lactate. Critical speed, critical power is measuring an actual performance level. But they're both trying to separate what is sustainable from what is not sustainable. So you should expect to have a small difference there, but you shouldn't. But it shouldn't be like something that you should expect that there could be a difference, but you shouldn't expect that there has to be a difference, because there doesn't have to be a difference necessarily. So I would still always try to, when it comes to setting zones in swimming, I would set three different zones: the low intensity zone, the moderate intensity zone, and the high intensity zone. And the moderate intensity zone is everything at and below threshold until like a certain point that is low enough that it's endurance. And the high intensity zone is anything above threshold where you just can't sustain it for that long a time. So that's the difference. You're trying to set the zone so that you can separate what is sustainable for a reasonable amount of time, let's call it 30 minutes, from what is not sustainable for very long at all. And I guess, yeah, that's how I would look at the training zones. For me, what I found with lactate testing is usually that the difference between LT1 and LT2 is about 5 seconds per 100 meters. So that's how I tend to, even if I don't test lactate, I do CSS testing, set the CSS first as the upper end of zone 2, and then set the upper end of zone 1 as 5 seconds per 100 below that. And that's a pretty easy way to do things, and I think it works fairly well. So yeah, those would be my comments on zones and thresholds.
Yeah, I definitely, I mean, I agree that CSS should align pretty similarly with you know, maximum lactate steady state, but the speed obviously will change based on if, you know, if you're doing shorter reps and with more frequent rest, then a higher speed can be maintained and you'll still be at, you know, that level. And the same is opposite is true, vice versa. Yeah, and then the zoning, I like the kind of system that you outlined there. You know, I would also kind of another simple zoning method would be kind of, yeah, you got your threshold around your CSS, and then plus 5 seconds would be your kind of tempo, minus per 100, minus 5 seconds would be your VO2 max, and then, you know, above slope, outside of those ranges is your anaerobic and your aerobic kind of zones.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, definitely. The next question is, form goggles are able to display heart rate from polar strap. When I swim hard, I feel like respiration is my limiter. Occasionally, I wear a Garmin chest strap that records heart rate for review later, and my heart rate never goes above what would be zone 2 when running. I rank myself as very amateur. Is heart rate more of a limiter as the athlete's swim technique improves, or is respiration typically a limiter?
I mean, yeah, I would say the specific conditioning is kind of required. Same as when I think Michael and I talked about this before, when a runner goes to cycling, they might benefit from, they can't get their heart rate up in the same way because they don't have that specific conditioning to the bike. And the same kind of is true here. Would you agree with that?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, absolutely.
I'd also make sure that you're breathing correctly. So make sure that you breathe out before the face rotates to the surface, so you're not having to do a rushed exhale and inhale when the face is out of the water, which is kind of a common mistakes. And also make sure that you, on the opposite end of that, you're holding the air in your lungs and kind of exhaling just before you rotate to breathe, rather than some people, as soon as they put their face under, are kind of exhaling straight away to kind of prevent what's coming up their nose or something. It's just kind of an almost instinctive thing to do, but that, you know, make sure that you're breathing correctly technically speaking as well.
That's kind of what I'm thinking reading this question, that it's likely an issue with the breathing technique. But if it's not, the other option that I can see is that maybe this is a very anaerobic athlete, so even at what they perceive as low intensities, they have a bit of CO2 buildup, and that's what makes it feels like they're a bit gassed and feels like the respiration isn't working properly. But it's really just CO2 buildup. And in that case, I would say that the solution is just to make sure that you're swimming even easier. And that might require things like swimming a lot with a pool boy, for example, or with fins, using tools to help you swim easier. Just make sure that you become efficient at producing your energy aerobically. But I think it's more likely that it's more of a technical issue, but it could be that you also need to focus a lot on the just making sure that you're doing all of that like easy aerobic swimming that you need to do to really adapt well to it. So let's take the final question, and then we can jump into some rapid fire questions from Instagram. So this one is 63-year-old male, started swimming at age 12, love doing 1 to 2 mile ocean races in the summer. My question is, most guests talk about training at specific distances related to your race. I'm about a 130 per 100 yard average swimmer over 1500 yards. While I can do 100s on 110 to 115 on repeats and even get close to 1 minute in a CB pool race, how do I improve my 130 pace to 120? What sets should I include in some or all of my 3 to 4 workouts per week? By the way, awesome show. You guys create one of my top 3 podcasts.
It sounds like you've got a good top end there, but perhaps lacking in endurance comparatively. So, you know, simply put, potentially adding some more endurance tempo work with some longer reps would be a good place to start. Doing some testing as well, as we talked about with the CSS and the longer rep, just to get some more specific data as well, would probably help inform your decision there, I would say.
Yeah, I would agree. Like if he's doing 4 swims per week, he could do 2 basic endurance swims with some technique work and open water skills, and then 2 harder swims. One might be a threshold swim. 8x300 is a great one. Building up to 10x300 even, and one could be more of a tempo swim with something longer, like it could be 6x600, depending on how long his swims are, and at a kind of tempo pace, that sort of low zone 2 pace in a 3 zone system. So 4 or 5 seconds below, 3 to 5 seconds below threshold, that kind of thing. Yeah, I think that's probably a pretty good basic recommendation based on those speeds. All right, so let's move into the Instagram question. So we haven't really seen these at all, so this will be off the cuff, and we will try to make them really quick. So Jack, favorite toys to correct form?
I'd say paddles. It's especially paddles without too many straps over the top. So if your hand entry is or alignment is wrong with them, they just kind of come off completely. So they force you to have a good hand entry catch and kind of alignment.
Yeah, and I'll add the snorkel. Snorkel is one of my go-tos. Longest reps in training in order to swim 3,000 meter open water in a half-distance triathlon?
1,000 meters.
Yeah, I think that sounds fair. Ratio of load to rest, like in running or cycling. For example, 2:1, 100s in 1:30, 45 seconds rest. I don't actually know what the question is. Do you understand the question? The question is whether the ratio, the work to rest ratio, should be exactly like running and cycling or equivalent.
Yeah, I'd say no. I think that is the question, and I'd say no. Probably going to reduce the rest in swimming comparatively.
Yeah, I agree with that, but I think that sometimes the work to rest ratios are too high still in swimming. So there is a happy medium there. But it depends on the workout. Sometimes they are too low as well, but yeah, it really depends on the workout. I think for example, for a lot of VO2 workouts, some coaches anyway, I would say prescribe 2 short rests in swimming, and the rest should be longer. But in running or cycling, you would like to have 1:1, whereas in swimming, you would maybe want to have 2:1, like in this example here. So it's still not the same as in running or cycling. That's at least my opinion on the work to rest ratios. Then my 120 per 100 meter becomes 130 in the open water. Tips to improve the pool to open water transition. I think we've covered this one, so we maybe don't need to go into it anymore. Next one, I see very little emphasis on swim bike bricks in training. Are they not useful?
Yeah, they probably do have their place if you have the facility or position, if you're in a position to do them, but I don't think they're necessary. And I think the biggest reason why they're not a commonplace is logistically it's quite challenging.
Yeah, I agree with that, but I think they are useful if you can do them. I've done them both on pool deck, getting the trainer to the pool deck, which we were lucky enough to do with the team here. And I think the squad that I have been training with, most of them focus on short course racing. So in that kind of racing, especially, it can be super important to do that sort of training. So they really focus heavily on doing that. And when racing approaches, they do that with relative frequency. And it makes a lot of sense. But I've also done it outdoors, and it's a bit more of a challenge logistically, but yeah, you can make it work with having the bike in the in the trunk of your car. So I think they're useful, but they are challenging, and you can get away with not doing them, basically. So
yeah, I think one thing there is also just the swim to run, as in the swim to the run in transition, is a good thing to make sure that's covered, because obviously that going from horizontal to vertical, as I'm sure people have experienced, is good to prepare for that a little bit.
Yeah. Well, yeah. How do you decide when to leave the draft during racing?
I think if the effort is, it depends on the race, I guess, depends on the race distance, and how close you are to the end of the race. But I'd say if in doubt, it's better to swim at your own pace in the long run most of the time.
Yeah. But it could also be the other, and I see where you're coming from with that. It could also be that the question is the train going too slow, and you kind of want to overtake it, and you can try to step to the side and see how much more of an effort you need to put out in that case, and then try to kind of. But then if somebody takes your place and you need to go to the back of the pack, or you need to go to the front, or stay at the side and do the work on your own, then it's a bit of a gamble. So I think it's worth always being aware of the fact that you are saving a lot when you're drafting off somebody, and to go faster, you might have to put in significantly higher effort. All right. Next one, benefits of swimming as cross training for the bike and the run.
I think it depends on your level. If you're focusing on cycling and running, then potentially would be worth focusing your energy more on them. However, as a triathlete, I think there is some crossover, especially at a more kind of a lower level, just because there's more to be gained from just putting in, you know, extra hours of training almost. Once you get to almost a higher level and you're almost fully, you're more optimized in, you're becoming more optimized in swim, then potentially there could be physical kind of developments that would hinder the bike and the run. But I think centrally speaking, there's definitely benefits from the swim to the bike and run.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny because we were talking about this before a little bit, and you see so many anecdotal examples of there must be a pretty big crossover when you see swimmers coming out of just swimming, and then you put a bike under them and they can bike like they've never done anything else almost. Running is a bit different because in running there are quite different biomechanics, but clearly there is a positive aerobic crossover effect. But interestingly, when you look at scientific studies, that has never really been shown as far as I can see, but it's largely related to how do you design the study, and you maybe not don't see it in a short training intervention period, but it's more of a long-term thing. I agree with you though that there are benefits, especially, but the more advanced you become, the more you need to train really specifically to gain further improvements, basically. I think that's a good summary. And the next one, is heart rate a good thing to look at in swimming?
Yes, definitely. I mean, as one of the questions we had earlier, they kind of recognized that their heart rate was a lot lower in the swim for the same effort. And so that is kind of... that shows that something needs addressing there. And I think with the swim, especially if you're not used to using the pace clock, and you can't get kind of splits, because it can be quite a nicely controlled environment and you can use pace really well. But especially if you struggle with that, then having heart rate as an extra kind of data point can definitely help.
Yeah, I agree. I think it can be very useful. It gives you, it's like in cycling and running, you have the external external load, the pace and the power, and you have the internal load, how hard is your body working internally, as the heart rate. So it's really useful to have the be able to triangulate dose and also RPE. And it's nothing new, really. Like, the technology to measure heart rate in the pool is kind of newish, but even in, I remember reading Bill Swetenham's champion, I think it's called Championship Swim Training, his book, and that book is from, I don't know, early 2000s, but a lot of the training concepts are from the 90s or even the 80s, and a lot of training is based around beats below maximum, so 5 beats below maximum or 10 beats below maximum, and they would just have the swimmers take their heart rate with their fingers, so it's not exactly new to be using heart rate in swimming. But yeah, the technology does help, of course. The final one is how to assess technique improvement without video analysis.
You already touched on the snorkel, which is a good one for looking at the hand entry and catch alignment, that kind of stuff. I think there's probably the gold standard would be to get a coach who kind of knows triathlon swimming to have a look at you, but even just getting a kind of friend to look as well could be insightful. Just thinking about what you're doing with every stroke, as we kind of touched on earlier, is not going to hurt. But without knowing what it is you're doing wrong, it is hard, I would say. And it's probably, you could bark up the wrong tree quite easily. A lot of people I've kind of done swim clinics with have had pretty kind of wrong ideas of what they should be doing from what they've been told by people. And it is even the specifics of a triathlon coach versus a swim coach. If someone doesn't know the differences there, then it is, you do need to be careful with it, I would say.
Yeah. I think that without video analysis, I mean, it depends on how you interpret that, because you can, like, it's so easy to get a friend to just video you with their phone and at least get above the water footage. And many phones now work below the water even. So I think that the challenge might be some pools will not be too happy with that. But in some cases, that's more of a case of just better ask for forgiveness than ask for permission and just get a quick 50 filmed and and you might be good with that. I think that's, you don't need necessarily, like, you can get a lot out of just getting yourself filmed on a mobile phone. It doesn't have to be that you always go and get a professional video analysis with a professional in your area, even though that obviously helps a lot and you will get the knowledge and the information of that person is the big thing, not just a video, but if you know some things about swimming, just getting yourself on a mobile phone camera, that helps a lot. Or, as you said, a friend that knows something standing on the side or at the end of the pool deck and watching. I would say try to do it with the video, not without the video, because it's quite easy to get and get it for free just using a friend and a mobile phone. If you don't want to spend the money, then you don't have to, but you can still get some video to make the analysis from.
Yeah, I know in Europe it's a bit easier, but in the UK they're very strict with most pools. I think one way to get around it I've done is if you hire a lane, sometimes they allow it in under that condition, which is worth doing, because if you hire a lane for 30 minutes or something, it's maybe 15 quid, which and if you're only doing it as a one-off, then it's definitely worth doing that.
Yeah that's fair. So that would be the solution then. But yeah, other than that, coach, friend to help you point out some things. But yeah, I guess that's it. And I know, well, we both have calls starting in 5 minutes. So thank you for this, Jack. It was very fun to have you. And thank you for sharing your expertise with these questions. I enjoyed it and I learned something. So hope we can do it again another time.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I hope, I gave some good information. Thank you.
Speak to you soon. Bye-bye.
Yeah.
I hope that you enjoyed this episode, and in particular that you liked the addition of a co-host for these Q&As. I liked it a lot, and I definitely hope that I can continue to do this with future Q&As. I just think it adds an extra dimension and is better and easier listening. So as I said, I will do the next Q&A episode in March, and that one will be on bike training. So feel free to email your questions to me already if you have questions on that. And you can follow along on Instagram and on the Scientific Triathlon newsletter if you want to get informed every time I put out a request for questions for upcoming Q&A episodes. You can find show notes for this episode on scientifictriathlon.com. And next Monday, I have an interview with Dr. Jose Arteta about energy availability and low energy availability. So that one will be a good one with quite a bit of science, but also practical application. And if you're interested in improving your triathlon performance, then consider using a coach or a training plan. You can check out what we have to offer on scientifictriathlon.com. Jack, who you got to know here today, is one of our coaches that currently has availability and is taking on athletes. So if you're interested, we can set up a discovery call with him and see if coaching with him seems like a good fit. Or you can check out all of the options that we have on scientifictriathlon.com. Finally, big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Fuel and Hydration, that you can find on precisionfuelandhydration.com. Use the free fuel and hydration planner to understand your fluid, electrolyte, and carbohydrate needs and get a specific and effective race strategy. And book a free video consultation with the team if you want to refine it further. Use the code TTS23 at checkout for 15% off your first order. And thank you to Form, that you can find on formswim.com/TTS. Improve your swim training with real-time metrics like pace, stroke, and heart rate, and advanced post-swim analysis, and use the code TTS15 to get 15% off the Form Smart Swim goggles. Thank you, as always, for listening. Keep training smart, and keep loving triathlon.